KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture on the Hearsay Culture Network. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate dean and professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, UNC's Center for Information Technology and Public Life, and the University of Milan's Information Society Law Center. We have some true guest favorites on Hearsay Culture and the Hearsay Culture Network, and I think, you know, maybe the most prolific guest that we've had is Lorelei Kelly, who is rejoining us today to discuss her new project, Defending the Constitution, and her current work and her perspectives on the state of Congress and the state of politics and the state of our information ecosystem around government, which is her life's passion, and I consider her one of the nation's leading experts in that space. We're going to be talking today, recording on July 17, 2025, about the state of play right now and the broader perspective on what people can do if they're concerned about where we are in the United States and arguably where we are in the world. And because of Lorelei's expertise in how Congress operates, she has a very interesting proposal that we're going to be talking about here in Defending the Constitution, where she calls for organizations to hold field hearings. Now that sounds very wonky and inside Washington, and so we're going to talk about what that means. But effectively, what Lorelei is suggesting is there's a lot of space for people to gather information, share information with the public, and in that way, not only educate the voting population, but more specifically, influence policy. And it's a very, in my view, underappreciated way to approach things. When you think about being a U.S. citizen and trying to influence politics, right? People think about phone calls, people think about emails, people think about protests. But the notion of organizing your own hearing is something that I haven't heard about people trying to achieve. And I'm not as close to all of this as Lorelei is, but I pay enough attention. And so it's a very interesting idea. And so defend the Constitution, that's where the proposal is. We're also going to talk a bit more about where we are in terms of how policy is made, how policy is decided, and what people might think about how that policy is implemented. And of course, again, given where we are in the United States right now, the rule of law is without question on the line. Some people think we've already crossed a gauntlet run the gauntlet and crossed the line into a place of lawlessness. I don't feel that way, but I definitely feel like we have to be very careful and very concerned about the direction in many ways that we're headed. So we're going to be chatting with Lorelei about all of these issues. By way of brief background, Lorelei is a principal in the new consultancy Public Good Group, where she is consulting in these spaces. She is, as I mentioned, a leading expert on U.S. Congress, on democracy and innovation, and on civic society and civic technology. I've known Lorelei now for, which I cannot believe, Lorelei, I've known you for nearly 20 years, which is nuts. She led the portfolio on congressional modernization for the research faculty at Georgetown University since 2016, where she's still affiliated. She previously led the Smart Congress Project at the New America Foundation. She's advised numerous lawmakers, think tanks, civic organizations. She has been published widely in a variety of places. She has a BA from Grinnell, a master's from Stanford, and she attended the Air Command and Staff College for the U.S. Air Force. She is joining us via Zoom from our nation's capital. For those of you on YouTube, you can see that the capital behind her, although it is a background, but it's a great background, as I have a background as well. Lorelei, thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture and coming back.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here and good to see you.
So I understand I want to kick this off here that you have an exciting new affiliation coming up with the University of San Diego, which I think leads into the direction that we're going to be talking about today. Tell us about that new affiliation and what that affiliation is going to be about.
Sure. So it's kind of me circling back to where I came from, which is sort of in the behavioral economics world of peace studies, which is how humans make decisions in uncertain situations. And I've always seen it as an effort to not only for, you know, interpersonal situations, but global situations. So I always was a foreign policy nerd. I'm going back to work with peace studies programs because I feel like the best presence we can have in the world is a functioning, healthy, modern, advanced democracy that is actually representative and that stands up for its own founding documents. So I'm going to be an affiliate at the Kroc Center, the peace studies program at University of San Diego, starting in September. I also am working with Women, Peace, and Security at Georgetown and governance programs because the work we've been doing in Congress for the last decade almost on modernizing the institution, it really needs to move out and get into the hands of the American people now so that we can rebuild and repair our democratic norms. And so I pivoted my work after the election, pivoted my work so that I can work in the states now, because that's where they're not just the laboratories of democracy anymore. They're the sandboxes of democracy and the maker spaces of democracy.
Yeah.
So we need to start getting a move on that. That's what's going to, I think, bring us back into balance from this overreaching executive and back to in line with checks and balances and the three branches of government and representative power.
You know, you're this defending the Constitution project. I keep saying defending. I don't know. Maybe it's more of an active word as I think about it. Defend the Constitution. Tell us about where that came from, and we'll get a bit more into the details of what the proposal is.
Sure. So again, I've been head down working in the little lake in the basement of the U.S. Capitol for the last several years with people working on the tech and data infrastructure of Congress, or what would be an enterprise architecture for this very complicated, unique legislature, the most powerful representative assembly in the world. Like, it's really an important institution. And let me just put some context out here. All of Congress, including its support agencies, meaning the experts that inform members, only got off the free version of Zoom in January. This institution is derelict, and we as citizens have not been paying close attention to what's been going on so that our legislature and our government in general can compete on behalf of public goods. And the executive branch and the Supreme Court, they're all important, but Congress is the heartbeat of the Constitution in this sense. It's Article One. It has, the functions of representation and connection back to regular American people. And it just has fallen apart on its ability to do that. And we can talk more about what's filling the space. Of course, it's weaponized news media, donor-funded priorities, constant campaigning instead of actually governing. So, like, what I see my job now is to re-incentivize governing. How do we create democratized democracy at this amazing moment when all this new technology and authentic citizen-generated data is available to us? So that's what I'm working on. Defend the Constitution. So this playbook that I wrote for citizens and civil society to organize field hearings, the website is constitutionaldefense.us. I just put together the most important lessons that I've learned as a person working inside and outside the institutions supporting the reforms. What's the most important space now for American citizens to start moving and creating these new norms in our democracy? Norms that are about collaboration, sharing, local initiative, and public goods. So that's what this playbook or field guide, whatever you want to call it, is. It's all online. If you want to look at it now while we're speaking, it's constitutionaldefense.us.
And so I want to be able to frame this for folks that aren't spending their days watching C-SPAN and pay attention to hearings. So first of all, I mean, you know, this is, you know, how a bill becomes law, you know, from the 1970s kind of question, but what is a hearing? Because, you know, we see hearings occasionally on television, right? And they tend to be theatrical, when they're on TV, but of course hearings are happening all over the place, at least historically in Congress, that aren't televised and where information's gathered. So just for those that are wondering what this role is of hearings in Congress, historically, what is a hearing and what is its purpose?
So in this building behind me there and over here, the House side and the Senate side, those buildings, which are the office buildings, have big hearing rooms, which you'll see in clips on television occasionally. Hearings are sort of the discussion layer of Congress. They are the deliberative layer of Congress. They're also the subject matter expertise layer of Congress. So when a member comes to Congress, this is the House side, which I know better, they get assigned to committees and they might not have any prior interest in that committee. They get plunked on these committees and they then need to generate questions, expertise. That's called the oversight process. What Congress is doing is conducting oversight over the executive branch and the agencies on how our taxpayer dollars are being spent. Are they effective? Is it doing what it's supposed to do? Is there an auditable supply chain of dollars into programming? A lot of that has fallen apart. And in fact, Congress has never really had a monitoring and evaluation function in its hearings. This is one of the things we can do with modernization is get a far clearer idea of how our money is being spent. But what members do, and you see this on TV, is they're usually sitting up on a dais and there's witnesses and an audience of people like me sitting and watching the hearings and others, lots of lobbyists, but nonprofits, regular people coming in to see how Congress works. And it's this kind of old, stodgy form of question and answer. And it's very hierarchical in the sense that every member gets 5 minutes, and then the witnesses respond, and then there's discussion afterwards. But it's very controlled in that sense. One of the things we did with the Modernization Committee in Congress, the Select Committee on Modernization, was open up and rearrange the room for the hearing process. So it was much more about a discussion and a conversation. And the members allowed the experts in the room to do most of the talking. And question each other. I mean, it was a real revolution when you think of this old stodgy process, which probably hasn't been updated for a couple 100 years at least. So a hearing is how members get information from experts. It's a controlled channel into the metabolic process of the legislature. Field hearings, though, are really interesting. They're an innovation that came out of the Civil War when members of Congress wanted to hear from on the ground information of how it was going. And so they moved the process out to the front lines. And so since that time, the 1860s, field hearings have been a way to move the institutional eyes and ears out among the people. And it has kind of fallen by the wayside in certain ways, or being used as a campaign stunt for talking points and clips. But at the same time, there are also field hearings that happen through committees across the country that can be very useful. And the problem with them is that they're very hierarchical in the sense they're controlled by the chair
Right.
and they're expensive. So you have to pay for them. So what I did was just take that process and write a guide to move it into the hands of civil society, because there's so much that we can do right now that mimics the process of Congress and creates a civic voice record. That's almost the most important part of this, I would say, is that we have the opportunity right now to create a record of this ongoing churn and change about how sort of executive actions are impacting local communities.
Right.
And I think that's the most important thing, is to not lose the archive and the memory of what we're going through right now, because we're going to need this information when we start to repair and renew this
Well,
democracy.
you brought up something I was going to mention later, but now since you mentioned it, I want to get to it because I think this is one of the least reported major problems that we have today, which is the destruction of information held by the federal government. And I'm not just talking about information that's available on the web, but what we really don't know about how information is being destroyed, and otherwise eliminated via DOGE and processes that are not transparent. Are you concerned? I mean, I'm sure you're concerned about it. So let me skip that part and ask you more specifically, given your expertise, how does that destruction happen? And are there ways to recover that information? But first, what's the impact? Because I think, again, people colloquially look at Congress, and I'm focusing on Congress here, but of course, we're talking about the executive branch as well, right? People look at Congress, and I think a lot of people think they're not paying attention to anything. But it's not really true that they don't pay attention to stuff. We have the CBO, right? We have we have research. What's left of, and you've written about the destruction of the research capacities of Congress, but what is it about information in this context that, and the loss of it, that's so concerning? And are there things that can be done about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in my 23 years working in and out of Congress, the probably the most egregious, worst impact of data loss, in my view, has been the privatization of the memory of American democracy. Congress is this is one of the most prodigious information data producers in the world as a publishing entity. It's just incredible when you see everything is put on the record from the hearings to the members' newsletters to floor speeches to all, as you mentioned, Congressional Budget Office, Government Accountability Office, Congressional Research Service, and then you have the Library of Congress sitting behind the building there. It's the largest library in the world. That said, certainly the destruction of data, the taking down of websites, the access to it by private entities like Palantir, I think are a dangerous patterns, dangerous trends. As someone who worked in the Soviet Union and East Germany, I am always extremely aware of the capture and cartel-like intentions of leadership that doesn't want to share information or that privatizes it into exclusionary private hands. And Congress, that sort of ends up being, giving the upper hand to purchased access to lawmaking. That would be lobbyists, donors. And since Citizens United, which was a Supreme Court decision in 2010 that declared that money equals voice, I think we've seen a real capture, not just of issues, but of process. So, I mean, from the states to the legislature, the supply chain of information going into policy, it's a captured process. It's almost like an information cartel for lawmaking. Members, I don't think, agree with this. And I think you could find that on both sides of the aisle still, is that they really want to hear from constituents in a more regulated, just regular way. Like, how do we build that information support system for lawmaking that can engineer us around Citizens United? Like, to me, that was the worst thing that's happened, because that incentivized hoarding. It took away this idea that you share for public good and for open public process. So yeah, taking down data, privatizing it, destroying it is really bad. It is a tendency of authoritarian regimes. We're seeing that more than ever now. That said, Congress as an entity has a lot of the most important data of democracy in shoeboxes in the basement or in dusty stacks in federal depository libraries around the country, 1,200 of them, or in PDFs hidden six links under a website at house.gov. And that would be witness testimony from the hearings. Like, witness testimony to me, even if you don't agree with a person, they swear on the Bible to present that. That's pretty good authenticated data. And the other thing in this world of AI that we're going into, one thing politics in a democracy always has as an ace in the hole is showing up in person and communicating information in an authentic discourse. And I think that that is going to be extremely important going forward. Because we've not only seen the weaponization and capture of the information ecosystem for lawmaking, AI is going to automate that and make it even worse. And you're seeing it in the building now with 60 bills introduced with slight changes, things like that. So, like, this flooding the zone with BS is happening everywhere. And we have to decide that that's unsustainable and it's going to lead us off a cliff. And definitely, I think people are waking up. Part of this, as you know, is the decimation of local nonprofit news. There's a lot of things in society that don't generate a profit. And the most valuable things in a society are not profit driven. For us to ignore that really is sort of, it shows like how far away we've come from sort of a shared vision of humanity. And I think that's how we fight going forward, is like, we can't go down this path. Like, all of us know it's making us sick and lonely. It's making a handful of people gazillionaires at the expense of a society that can hang together and solve the kind of problems we need to solve going forward. And even though people like to yell at Congress and get so mad at it, this is the most important part of American democracy. We can't just ignore it. But yeah, the data capture, the destruction of data, and the taking down of websites or the surveillance capitalism is another part of this, right? Where they're selling, everything's an advertising platform. Like, we have to change that business model for informing ourselves. Like, you can't run a democracy on an advertising platform. That has always been true. I know the people that pointed this out 20 years ago were called cranky and curmudgeonly. They were exactly right. And now we're seeing the outcome of that, the failure to protect this space.
We're chatting with Lorelei Kelly on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Lorelei, you've said so much there that that could be the rest of the interview, and just follow up on that. I will follow up on one point here, which gets us to discussing a little bit what the what your concept is, your proposal of civil society field hearings is. But I get this question a lot from people as in my heading of journalist and law professor, which is, and it's a question I've asked others. I'm going to ask you, you know, given the capture in variety of institutionally lobbyist money, go on, right? Of Congress, people of goodwill who want to influence things, whether they, you know, regardless of the side that they're on, will regularly bemoan the fact that what's the point, right? If I'm not a lobbyist, right? Or if I'm not plugged in, if my, you know, my brother or sister, you know, isn't, you know, a staffer, right? Why bother calling? Why bother emailing? Why bother showing up even, right? What's your take on that? I mean, before we get to the hearing idea, at the easiest fundamental level in a democracy, particularly in Congress, you pick up the phone and you call your member, right? Or you call your senator and you say, here's my opinion. And you don't have to say more than that, right? You say, I want you to do X. Thank you. Click, right? Is that still worth doing today?
I think the sort of the phone systems of Congress, you know, Congress just got a modern switchboard very recently, really, literally until a few years ago, the wires would melt down and it would stop. Yeah. So again, like, think about part of the disconnect between the American people and Congress are thick marble walls. Like, Congress just got routers in the building a few years ago so that you could get Wi-Fi while you were sitting in the Capitol. It's not an easy, and the same is true. You could see until last year, you could see Library of Congress staff walking up Pennsylvania Avenue trying to find a signal. Like, we have let it become derelict. And so at the most fundamental level, Congress hasn't been able to see or hear or get situational awareness in a broad sense about its own representative duties, right, and inform itself. On top of that, the incentive system for members over since Citizens United, in my view, 2010, has moved from governing to performance. And so members are performing for donors, they're performing for their sort of loudest base, they're performing for national audiences instead of governing for their constituents. It's going to be the American people and constituents geographically distributed in 441 districts across the United States that change that incentive system. I do a lot of research in frontline in district offices with staff and members, and one of the things I hear is just that members don't like to do town halls anymore. And that's been true since 2012 when the sort of Tea Party came on the scene and really sabotaged the public events. So they made them scary, yelled, dominated. There was no discourse happening. And so when members see that and they're wasting all this time doing it with their staff and themselves, and they've also gotten much more dangerous. Think about it, like members of Congress since January 6th, when a violent mob attacked the Capitol, have gotten escalating death threats. So over 200% more death threats. So then a lot of their time and energy is like, how do I stay physically safe? So we have to think about that in the context of like, how do we rebuild and renew this connection between members and their constituents? And why not move some of these functions that have been almost abandoned here in DC on Capitol Hill, move them into the states? Mm-hmm. So the reason
which brings us to your field.
A civil society field hearing is just mimics a function of Congress and moves the geography. Mm-hmm. In the rules of Congress, field hearings can happen everywhere. And a couple of the things that happened because of the pandemic was the ability to move functions online for remote technology, like we're having this discussion right now. So members can have hearings at a distance. Let me give you an interesting statistics. During the pandemic, diversity among witnesses in front of the official hearings of Congress went up 150%. Mm-hmm. That's because they could reach people all over the country. They could reach farmers in Montana and, frontline workers in Indiana and people working trying to do disaster response in Florida. Like, it's really, really important to understand that the bone structure of Congress is great. I mean, these are miraculous institutions. But the left and the right politically run against institutions. Like, nobody runs loving Congress. Everybody runs against it. But in fact, its bone structure is fabulous. If you read Article 1 in the US Constitution, and if you read the First Amendment, and this is why I'm really interested in helping sort of resurrect and reform some of the responsibilities of Congress to hear civic voice. The two clauses in the First Amendment, the right to petition and the right to assemble, are really under attack right now. They're brittle or fragile even. Right to assemble, town halls not working, members don't want to do it, open mic karaoke night for angry people. Nothing comes of it as a record that you can then use for lawmaking. So I'm trying to figure out, like, what are some of the other, how do we populate with a menu of options for members to convene safely and productively with their own constituents? Voting is going to be enough for a lot of people. So voting is a representative function, and that might be all you want to do. But in between elections, there's actually a movement worldwide right now to increase sort of civic interaction in lawmaking about the decisions that impact our lives. There's a movement to broaden the options outside of elections. So in between elections, we need to figure out what is the menu of options. And that's the space that's really captured, in my view, by old systems, which make it impossible. It's like calling and an intern answers, and maybe they know what you're talking about. Or, like, in the offices I worked with, you screened by area code on the phone on the conference, and then you, if you had something to write it down, you would. So it's gotten much more systematized since then. But there's no unified correspondence management system in the U.S. Congress. Think about that. It's 441 different cities trying to talk to each other. One of the things we did do with modernization is try to create a unified information system. That's going to take a while. And right now, you don't have an incentive system, like I said, for members to share. So we have to really go back to basics, understanding that there are functions we have to share to make a democracy succeed. And these field hearings are one way to do that. And that's because we're creating, it's not just convening locally with a more formal structure, a moderator, five witnesses, two panels of five witnesses who are answering very specific questions. They are providing public witness testimony. That testimony then gets entered into a record. So I'm partnered with a group out of Ohio State University, a nonprofit organization that is mapping the impact of the executive actions. And so these civil society field hearings testimony will go into an archive. What I'm going to work on is figuring out if there's an intake mechanism into the Library of Congress, because we can start using this civic voice, this locally generated lived experience expertise as a lawmaking resource. And I don't have to tell you this, Congress desperately needs this kind of statutory supplement because of another Supreme Court decision last summer called Chevron, which really diminishes the expert ability of federal agencies to interpret law. Congress really has to step up right now if we want to maintain this democracy in every sense.
And when you talk about Chevron, just to be clear for listeners, right, this is the ability of administrative agencies that have the experts, right? The Department of Energy, right, dealing with oil and gas or something like that, to interpret law, right, and apply law and provide definitional structure, which sounds really wonky, but it means how do we apply the law here in a way that achieves the goals that Congress set? And the Supreme Court more or less said, right, that deference to these experts is optional, more or less. Let me ask you before we pivot to some broader, not broader in terms of the topic, but some different issues that expand our discussion. So I to operationalize your idea, right? So I'm Bob Smith, and I'm in a state, and I have a particular issue that relates to Congress that I want to do a field hearing for. Now, your guide lays out actually some steps for it, but just at the big picture level, right? So a listener who says, "Oh, that sounds like a good idea. I'd like to try that. I know I can find a few people and do this." Broadly speaking, how do you do it? right? What is it that it takes for an individual to actually operationalize this kind of idea, aside from civil society groups, you know, that have, you know, have the capacity to do those things more easily?
Yeah, no, I would say just noting down, if you have friends and neighbors or in your community who are being impacted by executive actions and these really sudden cuts, which I consider against the law, because Congress is the one that spends the money. Congress is the one that creates agencies. So where I'm from, Northern New Mexico, it's going to be deeply impacted. It's a rural community. It's a poor community. It relies on things like cooperative extension. It relies on things like support for schools. I think that as an individual, think about who you know that has lived experience as a professional or as somebody who interacted with the government at this level and was supported to grow food for a local school that's healthy. That's the kind of person that I think would be really beneficial to get their voice on the record about how these cuts all of a sudden are impacting a community. So in my view, if you're a person sitting like where I'm from, San Juan County, New Mexico, Who are three people that you've interacted with that maybe didn't talk about it very much, but have really been, who are really, their livelihood is now gone or impacted by these executive decisions. You know, a lot of the headlines have been foreign aid. There's a lot of stuff that we're going to start seeing come down the pike that's very much domestic, and that's going to really harm domestic American communities. And so keeping an eye on that. But then also what we're trying to do here is create a more formal, I call it institutionally adjacent. That sounds really nerdy, but what it is doing is mimicking the muscle memory of the institution and doing functions that it's really not doing very well. So let's show Congress how to create a civic voice memory archive of what happened to this community with those decisions. The questions that I suggest are simple. They're like, you know, what was your job until recently? And what service did you provide this community? What is the community going to be missing now that you're gone? And if you had the chance to repair and renew your livelihood, how would you do it differently? Yeah. And the reason I think that third question is so important is that we need to not give up or concede the premise of reform. We could not go on like we were. We couldn't have gone on like we were. Like, as someone who's worked again in and out of the system for, you know, 20 something years, we desperately need to reform and modernize and update and help democratize this democracy, because it wasn't working as it was intended. Yeah. And so I think we can still, like, as we're seeing this real destruction, like, this is not how you reform a democracy. This is wanton, like, revenge and rage, as far as I can tell. And I have not seen an efficiency argument come out of it that's been compelling so far. Maybe it will. But in the meantime, we need to start creating a record of what's going on so we can take that information in a couple years or however long and use it as community-informed directions to move forward. That's how I see creating a record of what's going on. And it would be just get a library room. You could do this in a park. What it takes is a way to record it and a willingness of people to write three paragraphs of public witness testimony and then engage in a discourse. There's all kinds of really interesting tools out there right now that are kind of voice into data. You can do it on a Zoom. You can record it and then it organizes the information. You could submit that. So the idea here is, again, is to get some community voice into what's going into the sort of chaos that's happening right now so that we can have really solid first person authentic community information for moving forward.
So we're chatting with Lorelei Kelly on her proposal, Defend the Constitution, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Lorelei, you know, What we're talking about here, which is so important, you know, I think, and for listeners, is thinking about how do you actually influence things. Hearsay Culture listeners tend to be people who, you know, aside from being inquisitive and wanting some engaging content, right, are looking for expertise and are looking for ways to have not only their voices heard, but their knowledge heard. And I want to share with you in that context an interview or clip of an interview that PBS did a couple of years ago with former Congressman Adam Kinzinger, where he made an very interesting observation I want to get your response to with regard to why it is so difficult for members of Congress, right, to break free of their partisan relationships, and this is something which, of course, we've seen, happening, at an alarming level in the Republican Party, but it's true, to a lesser degree in the Democratic Party as well. So let me play you this clip, and I'd like to get your reaction to it.
I come to believe that people less fear death than they do being kicked out of their social circle. And what you've seen now in kind of these monolithic views, whether it's Republicans or Democrats or a gun control group or an anti-gun group, is people are afraid to go outside of the lines and have a little bit of a different belief because they'll be kicked out of their social circle. And that to humanity is probably one of the most frightening things.
So what do you think there, Lorelei? I mean, we try to figure out why members do what they're doing. What's your reaction to Congressman Kinzinger's insight there with regard to how Congress operates?
Yes, I like to call Congress the marble sandbox because it really is. I'm laughing now because our situation is funny. I'm laughing because I always tell people Congress is a lot like junior high. I mean, there's factions that are social factions. You see them, the jocks and the cheerleaders and the nerds, and the people in the reading club. You can see them gathering together. But what the problem that he's identifying, I think, is much more in Congress because of power dynamics and funding dynamics. And again, this in the incentive to perform for parties and donors, not to work for the American people. I think that it's much more of a Congress problem than it is an American people problem. When I go home, I don't agree politically with 90% of the people I interact with all day, but we get along great when it's just regular life. Like I call it, dogs, dumps, and democracy. Like we're all doing the same thing in San Juan County, New Mexico. I think that's a problem of the incentives of our information ecosystem, the demise of local news. The other part about these civil society field hearings, and that it's elaborately and detailed, everything from a press release to how you set up a room in this constitutionaldefense.us. That's where this is. There's a podcast. You can listen to a 10-minute overview of what I'm asking you to do. Is to figure out how to recreate that sort of social cohesion at the local level and create an incentive so that members see that that's this real partisan name calling is not what the American people want their members to do. And it should, members who don't communicate consistently with their constituents, to me, is a reason to not elect someone. I think it should be a reason to not elect someone. I do think over the last 20 years of working in and out of Congress, this incentivizing division instead of collaboration is very much a function of donors and nationalization of the news and top-down control by party leadership. And this honestly has happened on both sides. I came to work in Congress after Speaker Gingrich sort of wiped out the connecting shared layers of information sharing in Congress, the caucus system, Office of Technology Assessment, a third of committee staffs. Again, there were reasons for reform that were legit, but what it ended up doing is privatizing that information sharing. Again, back to the original problem and hoarding, instead of this sort of community of sharing. And unless we incentivize members to do that, they're not going to hear that signal from the top. You can look at the data of Congress and see the policy positions. Those are the nerds who talk to each other over lunch in the cafeteria. Those positions have become communications positions in leadership. Yeah. So Congress is barking orders out on talking points, very often funded by the same people who are funding campaigns, by the way. It's not authentic anymore. And I think everybody's feeling that, who is this representing? Yeah. So we have to change that incentive. It's a systems problem. There's no avoiding this fix as a systems fix. And again, the people who have the energy, the courage, and I think the dedication to do this and aren't living in fear of retaliation are citizens. They're people in 441 districts across the USA. Yeah. So that's why I'm trying to help us get a little more organized so that the signal coming from these civil society field hearings is a bit more organized and sophisticated than a protest, for example. And I'll just go back to sort of Gandhi's you know, you need more than a protest. You have to have a constructive program. You can't just protest. You need to build.
Right.
And we're really at a place where we have to really reform and renew and repair our whole democratic system. What's exciting about it to me is that the parts are in place to do that if we tap them and move them forward in a way that serves society instead of private interests.
Well, that's a whole topic for another show, which you started off with, which is the privatization of all of this. I know you're on a tight schedule. You have about 10 minutes, and I want to jump into a couple other things here related to it. You know, I've been thinking about, as you've been talking through all of this, you know, you think about how do you get at these problems to resolve them? And I can hear listeners in my mind. Okay. Not because I've lost my mind, but because I'm familiar with our listeners, right? Who are saying, oh, my God, you know, great idea, Lorelei. And thanks, Dave, for having Lorelei on, but this sounds complicated and exhausting. And I'm tired. And this is kind of what I'm getting at. The number of people that I know who are in powerful positions, right? And by that, I'm not talking about Congress. I'm talking about people in our country who are in leadership positions, who are in positions of influence in their institutions, in their communities and so forth, who have said to me, Dave, I'm tired, or, right, I can't take it. Like, I can't handle it, which again, might be, sadly, the entire Steve Bannon playbook, right? But, right, this is a problem that we have, right? This is a problem. And a lot of people that are doing the kind of work that you're describing, I think, today, don't really want to do it, but they feel like they have to do it, right? Yes. So we have Congress on one side and the institutional challenges there. There's a lot of people that also take a look at society. And so my question for you is, for people that are saying, this is exhausting and I'm exhausted, all right? One response is, say, do it for your kids, do it morally. But, you know, honestly, that only gets so far. Do you have a reason? I mean, maybe that's your response, but do you have a way to encourage people who are truly tired, right, and exhausted and almost feel like I can't keep up with it, I can't handle it, for health reasons or other reasons? What do you say to those people?
Well, I mean, I think that goes back to the sort of Congress as junior high. Like, there's a lot of good things and bad things about that. The contagion model works in Congress. People still do what they hear people, their peers talking about in the elevator, on the way to the floor, in the hallway, especially at the member level. And so one or two successful models and prototypes right now can really become contagious, mm-hmm. As a constructive way forward. Because I think people are exhausted. Even like my sort of Republicans that I'm still working with or connected with in Congress they're living a double life. Like, you know, they were there on January 6th. They saw what happened. They know we can't go on like this. And then you have Trump releasing everyone and pardoning them. And so now there's this double threat. It's much scarier. People are exhausted at every level. At the grassroots level, I would just say that look at this as another one of your mutual aid community efforts. Mm-hmm. Like, mutual aid, I love. We need a mutual aid movement for democracy right now, which is that you start where you are with the person standing in front of you and what you're holding in your own hands. Luckily, it might be a phone, yeah, which means you can do a civil society field hearing. Yeah. And again, like the things listed in this guide that I put up are really trim tabs on an aircraft carrier. So a trim tab is the little rudder on the rudder of the aircraft carrier, but it's actually what can turn the ship. And I know too, it's exhausting. So many of people have lost so much funding. There doesn't seem to be support. It seems to be risky to stand up for democracy right now. The truth is that these kinds of hopeful paths forward, these illuminating that path forward and standing up in a community way, you don't even have to talk about the parties. You don't have to talk about the president. Just start doing things differently, because what's happened in the last several years is we've obliterated our norms of democracy, which includes sort of community sharing, information sharing, a shared vision of a shared future. I would say it's not, we're going to get there the same way, but we're all going to be together in this boat moving forward. And I think simply standing up for that we're going to be together in this challenge, in this democracy moving forward, And it's not going to be a zombie apocalypse like The Last of Us. It's not going to be a civil war. We already got a lot of distributed violence. We've created a permissive environment for violence in this country. And we've got to stop that now.
Yeah.
And one of the ways to stop that now is to divert into productive change. This is a little step toward that productive change. Hopefully, I'm going to be able to do a lot more of this and do workshops and actually be there and help people hold hands and help people figure out how do we do the functions of democracy that are not necessarily need to be captured on Capitol Hill anymore. And that, frankly, can I tell you, like at the beginning, that's how it was supposed to be. It took a pandemic for us to realize that we need to renovate, renew, reform ourselves, and we have the chance now. And a lot of people are feeling scared and exhausted. I would just argue that if you're already organizing new groups, if you're working with young people who have all kinds of energy, this isn't that heavy of a lift. A lot of what it is you're convening anyway. Put some structure around that convening to put it on the record. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm asking people to do, because then we have a civic voice record. It's a congressional record that we can use for all kinds of purposes moving forward. It's a baby step, but it's also a trim tab that can move the aircraft carrier.
Lorelei Kelly of the Public Good Group and the author of Defend the Constitution. I know you've got to go. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. We'll, you know, definitely have you back. And I encourage my listeners to check out Lorelei's truly unique idea and operationalize it as it moves you. Lorelei, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Hearsay Culture, right, is on the Hearsay Culture Network and on KZSU. And I wanted to take a few minutes here as I wrap up the show to kind of give listeners a bit of an update on what we've been doing at Hearsay Culture, because it's been a very eventful summer. We're recording in mid-July, but also a very eventful couple of years. You know, listeners have reached out to me over the last several years and said, what are you up to and what are you doing? And I wanted to give a little more context to what we've been doing, because I think it's important. You know, I've been doing, and by the way, this sounds like I'm ending the show, but I'm actually not. But I realize as I say this, it sounds this way. So, I launched Hearsay Culture when I was a fellow at Stanford Center for American Society nearly 20 years ago, inside of almost 20 years, in May 2006. And I did it because I had left practice as an attorney, and I wanted to not only learn and get into the reading and the fields that I was in and I was entering, which I was an intellectual property law attorney and litigator in New York, and I had been exposed to technology issues, but I really wanted to read up on the literature and the expertise around the operations of the internet, having been encouraged really and inspired by the work of Larry Lessig, who I worked with when he was at Stanford nearly 20 years ago. And in so doing, when I found out that KZSU existed at Stanford and that there was a radio station more or less across campus from the law school, I thought, this is fantastic. Having been previously, when I was in high school, air cleared by the FCC and having experience with radio, it didn't take too long for the staff then to clear me to put Hearsay Culture on the air. And so I did my first interview in May 2006 with an anonymous online gambler, because at the time this was illegal behavior. But, a few shows later, Larry was on and the rest is history. And so we've done, I've recorded well over 300 Hearsay Culture interviews. In 2016, as a result of the first election of President Trump, I stepped back a bit from Hearsay Culture. I still did shows, but I stepped back a bit and focused on advocacy work. But that was when I started, working with my friend and colleague, colleague, Howard Greenfield, in expanding hearsay culture to what we now call the Hearsay Culture Network. Unfortunately, for me and for millions of other people who were working on projects, COVID hit. And of course, you know, the impact on me, you know, pales by comparison and is not comparable to the hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people who died during COVID. But as a result of COVID, my efforts to expand hearsay culture, you know, more or less slowed down because the world changed. But here we are today in 2025, and I'm very excited for what we're doing. You know, so Hearsay Culture on Stanford Radio is the flagship, and I'm very excited about interviews that I have coming up with terrific guests, you know, including in the coming few weeks, Deirdre Keller, who's the former dean of Florida A&M Law, and we're going to be talking about how to encourage innovation thinking in higher education, particularly in light of AI. We're going to be talking with Melody Dinser from UCLA's UCLA Law, who has launched a tech advocacy organization focusing on AI. And we have other guests coming down the road that I'm really excited about, authors, activists, business people, technologists, and so forth. But Hearsay Culture also, right, is the Hearsay Culture Network has expanded. And so when you go to hearsayculture.com, you can hear shows from my colleague and friend, Denise Howell. Denise is or was the host of This Week in Law on Leo Laporte's network for 20 years. Denise is a podcast and video podcast veteran who's done hundreds of shows. Denise and I do a show called R&D with D&D, where we talk to guests have extensive discussions about a variety of topics in their areas of expertise with some key takeaways coming out of it. Denise also hosts a show on the Hearsay Culture Network of her own called Uneven Distribution, where she is having long-form discussions with guests in a variety of areas. She recently interviewed, for example, Marina Gerner, the author of the book The Vagina Monologues, about why it is that the pharmaceutical industry tends to underinvest in women's health. And then I've got a show on Hearsay Culture that I am in the process of launching called Secrets, focusing in my area of expertise professionally, which is trade secret law and technology and information sharing. What do we think we know about technology and business and culture, but we don't? And what can we actually learn if we dig a little deeper? So I'm excited about that. All of that, though, more broadly, is to make a key point, which I want to make here. And I make it in the context of KZSU and Hearsay Culture. As Lorelei alluded to, information sharing is under attack. Radio is under attack. You know, as we're recording on July 17, 2025, right? PBS and NPR are being threatened with defunding, at least at the federal level, which can have and will have an enormous impact. Perhaps not as much on the Bay Area or in areas where you've got plenty or at least a lot of radio and media outlets, but in more rural areas, like where Lorelei referred to in New Mexico, or even where I'm recording in central Idaho right now, where my in-laws live. What Hearsay Culture is about, right, is sharing good information with a broad range of people, not Republicans, not Democrats, not people who are Black, not people who are white, Jewish, Christian, with everyone. And using the internet through podcasting as a way to share it, not just locally, right, but nationally and internationally. And this ideal comes from the launch of the internet itself, which idealistically was viewed as a way by the people who created it as a way to bring people together by connecting them and being able to share knowledge. I refuse, because I don't think it's true, to believe that even in 2025 that people can't be better connected and can't better understand each other. A local a local religious leader in Greensboro, North Carolina, where I live, because I'm a full-time professor at Elon University, Odell Cleveland Jr., said about a year ago that, you know, with regard to Zoom, he said it's really hard to hate in person. And I do think our disconnectedness because we are not in person, again, as Lorelei referred to, is one of the big reasons why we have so many divisions. The point being this, I encourage you, if you're listening to Hearsay Culture, if you listen to KZSU, if you value public information, to take a stand now to support not only KZSU, and not only public radio, and not only Hearsay Culture. By the way, you can make donations, because this is an effort that operates through subscribers and donations at this point at hearsayculture.com. But more than all of that, I encourage you to take a stand for public information sharing, and for public information sharing of good information, of verified information, of information that is accurate, right? Information that helps people understand our society, because that attack goes to the heart of democracy. That attack goes to the heart of whether we have an enlightened society, whether we have a functioning society, and whether we have a country in which we want to live. So this show is being recorded on July 17, 2025. It is airing on KZSU July 18th, 2025. And while things are moving so fast, I encourage all of my listeners and everyone listening to KZSU to reach out to your elected officials, even, by the way, if they're Democrats, because it doesn't really matter, and encourage them to stand for, in particular, public media, right now for NPR and for PBS, but more broadly for supporting media outlets broadly, right? And that includes KZSU. Without this fabric, we become even more disjointed. And it is radio and television and newspapers, right, that brought this country together from a disparate group of people to at least being unified around the concept of what it is to be American and what it is to have information that we can all understand. So that is my pitch. And that is the time that I wanted to take here to make that. Support KZSU. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu to make donations. Support Hearsay Culture. I'd certainly be grateful for that by going to hearsayculture.com. But even more than that, today, now, reach out to your elected officials wherever you are in the United States in particular, right? And contact them and say you support NPR, you support PBS, and you support the government supporting accurate, good information for the betterment of society. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. Thank you for listening to KZSU. Please stay tuned for more diverse programming, and have a great day.